I was going to ask you a bit about how you were able to balance your teaching requirements and playing for the club. I mean, what were the requirements for the club at that stage?
Basically, we trained twice a week. We played most Wednesdays and Saturdays. If you were the first team, you played on a Saturday. If you weren't, you might have played on a Wednesday. Having said that, some of the biggest games at that time were games against Welsh sides, which normally took place on a Wednesday night.
Now, before you came to the Gloucester club, who did you contact? How did it work to enable you to get into the club?
It basically was a case of during the end of August, September, because at that time I don't think you were allowed to play rugby before the 1st of September. And I think there's some mileage in that as well. But basically, you came to the training sessions if you thought you were going to be potentially good enough to play. And then there were a series of trial games at which you got your opportunity to play. And out of that, was asked to become a playing member of the club.
That's interesting because according to the statistics, your first season was actually, you played 28 games for the club in your first season.
I think if I remember correctly, and this is, that I actually started to play in January of 1986, although I didn't then properly play until the September. I think I played two or three games for the United, got injured at Leicester, a knee injury, and by the time I was then fit again, the season was almost finished, so I went back and played a few games for the Dings.
Yes.
And then came back again in September 86, back to the trials. So
who were the key figures at Gloucester in your first big season of 1986 to 87?
Well, I think I made my debut against Glamorgan Wanderers. I found one of the cuttings with a chap called John Roberts, and I think there was somebody else as well, but I can't remember, in quite a decent game. And obviously people like Richard Mogg and Paul Taylor were the centre partnership. Nick Price playing on the wing, who was always a larger than life character and an absolutely brilliant finisher. And kind of playing fullback. I've always been quite good at talking, and so I set out to make sure that I organised those very, very good defenders as best I could, so that I didn't have to do too much of the things I didn't like, which was tackling and stuff like that.
What was the sort of training regime in those days? Was it organised by anybody, or was it fairly relaxed?
I'm sure we had a coach, but I'm not sure who it would have been. Keith Richardson coached for quite a lot of the time that I was at the club. But it was basically train twice a week. So it would have been Tuesday, play Wednesday, Thursday, and depending on whether you were playing on the Wednesday, that would have modified. But it was quite a lot of what might be termed bash, which was to run the length of the pitch, jog across the side, and then run the length of the pitch. A few drills, I suppose, as time went on.
I mean, were there tactics discussed at any stage?
It was fairly simple. The forward pack was very strong. The 9 and 10 would kick the ball probably more than they needed to. But the first priority was to get the ball in front of the forwards and get the side moving forward. But I do think, we did have some very good backs. And, I think Richard Mogg, had he lived in London and played for a London club, would have got many, many England caps. There weren't too many Gloucester backs, probably Peter Butler and Peter Kingston, previous to that, who played for England. But I'm sure that Richard, should have been, I think, great example of how the game has changed, in that, he would regularly turn off on a Wednesday evening to play Pontypool or one of the other big Welsh sides, having been working all day, digging holes, repairing sewers and things, and would play, like a man who had a nice easy day, and 11 and a half stone, but a naturally strong, powerful, great player.
You come with a great sidestep too.
Absolutely,
which would help.
Yeah, superb player.
You came from Bristol through Saracens, from a slightly different background, if I may put it that way.
Yeah,
from
absolutely.
A number of your working colleagues at the club.
Yeah.
Can you say a bit about how they received you and how it worked?
Again, you know, when I first joined the club, I think there was a chap called Steve Lazenby, who was an RAF fullback who left at the same time I joined, which may have been quite fortuitous. But myself and Richard Pascal were the only two players who weren't from, you know, Cheltenham, Lydney, Stroud, Gloucester.
Yes.
And I'd come down from London and, you know, may have been regarded as a slightly soft London rugby player. Some of the touch was interesting. I did seem to find myself on the floor, having been touched rather vigorously in those early days. And it wasn't really until, you know, in conversation with people, I said that I was actually a Bristolian and had played my rugby for Dings Crusaders, who, yeah, at that time were, you know, the Bristol equivalent of Gordon Leeds and Matson's. And from that, I kind of got a little bit more credibility and, you know, gradually settled in.
Yes. So you're talking about, in effect, sort of 10 plus 1 rugby in those days.
I think we were probably better than that.
Okay.
But yeah, there was an emphasis on forward power. And you know, I can remember when I was coaching the academy after I'd finished playing, you know, that Philippe Saint-André, you know, his big focus was a big scrum.
Okay.
And, you know, whatever you say, you know, you can't play open expansive rugby if you can't win the ball. So, mm-hmm. you know, that is a priority. But again, as I said, you know, people like Derek Morgan, Nick Price, you know, Jim Breeze, who, you know, potentially was slightly agoraphobic in terms of preferring to run through and over people than round them. you know, there were Tim Smith, obviously, you know, very talented player at fullback as well. You know, Mike Hamlin, you know, a good fly half, and Marcus Hannaford. You know, there were some very good backs. Damien Cummings, Don Caskey, Roy McLean, all players who played, you know, around that time.
Who was your first captain, I wonder? Was it Malcolm Creed?
It probably would have been Malcolm, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
It was Malcolm.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think Malcolm did it for 2 years.
Marcus Hannaford.
Yeah, or 2 years. Mike Hamlin did it for a couple of years as well, I think. That.
I think Gloucester changed. You were talking about the, you know, the fairly limited rugby. I think Gloucester did change under Marcus Hannaford to a certain extent, didn't they?
I think with both Marcus and Mike, you know, because they were backs, mm-hmm. you know, they were interested, you know, and as I said, I don't think we were, you know, we were a powerful forward side at all times, and the club always has been, but we were, you know, we had some effective try scoring backs, you know, in that time. And
I mean, in your first season, we see that you scored 202 points.
Right.
A number of tries, 39 conversions and 32 penalties.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, obviously the kicking duties were really interesting. I'd kicked goals when I was at the Dings and done it fairly successfully. When I went to Exeter, there was a guy called Simon Hogg. Who played for a long time for Bristol,
yes.
Who kicked with both feet, you know, similar to Paul Mansell, that he could kick goals with both feet. And so therefore I didn't do it at Exeter, and I didn't do it at Saracens. Mm. And kind of when I came to Gloucester, somebody at that time, it might have been Mike Nichols, said, "Do you play 15, do you kick goals?" And obviously, wanting to, you know, give myself every opportunity to play in the first team, I said, "Well, yes, I have done." And not realising that actually, if you put on the 15 shirt, you kick the goals.
Okay.
And you know, through my career, I think, you know, it'd be fair to say that both myself and Tim Smith, who you know, we kind of vied for the fullback position for quite some time. It was really about, you know, we were both quite good rugby players, but it was who was kicking the most goals most consistently.
Yeah.
We both had our good periods, and we both had our bad periods, and you know, it would be the conversation with somebody. We're going to leave you out this week because you're not kicking enough goals, and Tim's kicking more goals. And I'm sure they had the same conversation with Tim at times as well.
Tim Smith came on the scene possibly just after you arrived, did he?
I think Tim was already here.
He was already here, yes.
And kind of, yeah, for the first, I don't know, 3-4 seasons. Very much it was one of others. And then Keith Richardson, you know, had the idea that he wanted to play me in the team, so I went onto the wing and then,
yes.
you know, played... you know, 11 or 14, preferred 14 because my left hand is a better hand off than my right hand, but, you know, quite happy to play on either, quite happy to play in the first team. I mean, that was, you know.
Yeah,
Tim had played for, I think, several seasons.
Yeah, quite possibly before you came.
He was pretty established by that time.
Because in fact, in the 1990-91 season, playing on the wing, you were actually the top try scorer in the side.
I suppose that's one of, you know, as a sporting achievement goes, to be the leading try scorer in a top class club is something to be very proud of, and I'm very proud of that. Yeah.
You had a hat trick against Plymouth Albion. Do you remember?
Yeah,
that?
I do. Yes, I think it was 71 something, and that's on one of the videos that we've got. We played in those awful yellow shirts that day. I remember very horrible, early acrylic. It was not nice. But it was great. But again, you know, wingers are only as good as the guys inside them, and Don Caskey, Damien Cummins at that time.
You spoke about the strength of the scrum, and I see from some of our records that there was a back row trio of Mike Teague, Longstaff and Gadd. Do you remember them?
I missed Mike Longstaff. I think Mike Longstaff retired, but certainly Mike Teague, John Gadd, and then Ian Smith. Formidable unit. And I think, John Gadd, had he been a Harlequin, would have played a lot of games for England. If we're talking about enforcers in sport, I think Mick Skinner at the time thought he was, he was the big enforcer, but yes, he was always very quiet when he played against Gloucester and against John Gadd. And Mike, superbly talented rugby player, could do everything.
Was there a feeling amongst the Gloucester players about the difficulty of getting into international recognition, do you think? Or did they just take it on the chin?
I think people just accepted that it was perhaps more difficult. And again, that's probably a Gloucester perception. Well, so certainly the people at England would argue that was merely a perception rather than an actuality. Ooh. But
talk to Peter Ford.
Absolutely. And as I said, certainly those two, obviously we know all about Mike, and latterly, people like Rich Pascal, Kevin Dunn played England B. I think Mike Hamlin, Marcus played England B. So we weren't far away, but I just think,
you were far away from London.
The lens perhaps didn't get down here often enough.
There weren't many motorways in there.
Perhaps didn't get past Bath as well. So, yeah.